So in a moment, we're going to be looking at Exodus chapter 30, the first 10 verses, and Luke 1. But I first want to say a few words by way of introducing this coming series of sermons and the one this morning. So it's the first Sunday of Advent, as we said a couple times, and we're going to begin taking what we can think of as a Sesame Street look at two birth announcements. I know the kids have all left, but you're doing the Sesame Street look at the two birth announcements. This will be happening throughout the next four Sunday mornings. What that means is that we're going to be asking ourselves, as we think of these two birth announcements, what's the same about the announcements and what's different about them? One is the announcement of John the Baptizer's birth coming, and one is the announcement of Jesus' birth coming. So the series of sermons in which we're going to do this is titled, With God, All Things Are Possible. And the series is planned to take us right to Christmas and, in fact, to finish in our Christmas service. This morning, we're going to start by looking at part of the story, just part of it, of the angel's birth announcement to Zechariah, and especially at the historic significance of the timing and location of that announcement. And we're also going to try and imagine just a little bit what the experience might have been like for Zechariah. Next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll look at the angel's birth announcement to Mary and her response to it. And we're going to examine these stories through the eyes and mind of gospel writer and Jesus story investigator, Luke. I encourage you, on your own time after this service, to read Luke 1's different accounts and compare them. Where I came to some of what I am going to share with you in this series is by taking the stories separately and holding them side by side and taking a colored highlighter and using color themes to highlight things that are the same and things that are different. I printed them out and I marked them up and found some amazing patterns using Sesame Street techniques, not seminary techniques. But the Sesame Street technique helped along with the seminary technique to understand this. So here are some of the things to think about as you read them if you take that time. Ask, what does Luke tell us about Zechariah and Elizabeth and about Mary and Joseph that is the same for each, and what differences are evident? What does Zechariah say to the angel, for instance, that's different than what Mary says? How are Elizabeth and Mary different in this experience? And how are they the same? Studying the two accounts side by side, I've become personally convinced that Luke has carefully arranged the very shape and details of the telling of these two stories to make other things clear about what he knows is happening in God's plan as these two babies are announced to their parents and to the world at large. So with that, we're ready to begin exploring this together. And I want to take you to Exodus chapter 30 first, where instructions are given. This is the instructions for how the temple should be built, how furniture in the temple should be built, and then some of how it is to be used. Make an altar of acacia wood for burning incense. It is to be square, a cubit long and a cubit wide, and 2 cubits high. Its horns of one piece with it. Each corner had kind of a protrusion that they called a horn. Overlay the top and all the sides and the horns with pure gold. Can you picture it? And make a gold molding around it. Make 2 gold rings for the altar below the molding, 2 on opposite sides to hold the poles used to carry it. Make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. Put the altar in front of the curtain that is before the Ark of the Testimony, before the atonement cover that is over the testimony. And then here's our key phrase out of this reading, where I will meet with you. This is God speaking. So he tells them where to put it, and it's in a place where God will meet with them. Aaron must burn fragrant incense on the altar every morning when he tends the lamps. He must burn incense again when he lights the lamps at twilight, so incense will burn regularly before the Lord for the generations to come. Do not offer on this altar any other incense or any burnt offering or grain offering, and do not pour a drink offering on it. Once a year, Aaron shall make atonement on its horns. This annual atonement must be made with the blood of the atoning sin offering for the generations to come. It is most holy to the Lord. So there's some background. And now we go over to Luke chapter 1. We're mainly interested in verses 5 to 25, and within that verse 11 particularly, but I'll start at verse 1 just to set a context. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, which it could be a made-up name. It's a lover of God. So this letter is addressed to anyone who loves God and wants to explore his ways. Most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. In the time of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were upright in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commandments and regulations blamelessly. But they had no children, because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well along in years. Once, when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And when the time for the burning of incense came, all the assembled worshipers were praying outside. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid. Zechariah, your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to give him the name John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from birth. Many of the people of Israel will he bring back to the Lord their God. And he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure of this? I'm an old man and my wife is well along in years." The angel answered, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to tell you this good news. And now you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at their proper time." Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondering why he stayed so long in the temple. When he came out, he could not speak to them. They realized he'd seen a vision in the temple, for he kept making signs or gestures to them, but he remained unable to speak. When his time of service was completed, he returned home. After this, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and for 5 months remained in seclusion. "The Lord has done this for me," she said. "In those days he has shown his favor and has taken, in these days he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace among the people." So that's as far as we'll read. That last verse we read will become important later on, but for now it's that one I emphasized out of Exodus, and then verse 11 here, "Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar." I ask you to imagine for a moment what Zechariah might have been thinking and feeling leading up to this encounter with the angel. We're imagining it. We're making some of it up just to try and get into what this would have been like. I'll lead you in that imagining with some mixing some facts that we know about the time and the duties of a priest with what we just simply know about human nature. This will help us imagine, maybe, how Zechariah might have been holding his breath, for instance, while the lot was being cast in the account we just read. We will understand that if his name came up in the lot, it would be the pinnacle, the peak of his career as a volunteer Jewish priest. Zechariah was getting to be an older man. He'd been coming into Jerusalem to serve in the temple for 2 separate weeks each year since he was old enough to start. And each time he would do his share of the team of priests' work of the week, and he would hold his breath probably along with the others when it came time to for that picking, for that casting of lots, for who of the crew would be the privileged one. Who of the some 18,000 priests that there were would get to perform the thing you only got to do once in a lifetime, if you got to do it at all? Zechariah likely knew of other priests who had died without their name ever coming up in the lot. Would he be one of them as well? He'd lived a good life. He had married a daughter of a priest, which was considered a special blessing, and the children they then, when they got married, had hoped for would have been considered a special blessing and of a pure priestly line in that way. He and his wife, as we're told in the passage, like God had nothing against them, is one way of saying what is written there. And it's not, doesn't mean that they weren't sinful people, but that they had been sincere in how they had served God and obeyed and been faithful. From what we know then, even from that, it's easy to understand that there might have been just 2 things out of Zechariah's life that left him unfulfilled and probably even somewhat sad. The first would be that Yahweh God had not blessed he and Elizabeth with children. The second would be that he had not yet had a turn as a priest burning the incense in that inner part of the temple. The first sadness, he was at a stage where that he had more or less come to accept, though it was difficult to come to terms with that. People talked, you know. People thought he or his wife had done something wrong which caused God to look away from them and not give them children, and that was hard. Hard to know that people thought that. And at times he might have even thought it himself and wondered. But Zechariah knew in his heart when he reflected that they had both been faithful to God. So although he didn't understand, he reluctantly had begun accepting their childlessness. And now, well, now it was a physical pretty well impossibility so to be reproductive parents anymore. It's possible that in reflecting on this, they had often reminded each other of Bible stories where a miracle had occurred before. Of Abraham and Sarah's long childlessness and eventual miracle child. It's possible that they shared these stories with each other to keep their hopes up. They remembered Hannah's story and the miraculous providence of Samuel, and they remembered Samson's birth as a special birth. But then maybe he would also think to himself, I'm no Abraham. I'm no Manoah, and Elizabeth is no Sarah. God won't do the same for us. And in that, you have to understand that in the Bible, Zechariah and Elizabeth represent Israel. We looked at Jonah before, and I talked about how he's a representative of his own people. They represent where Israel was at that time in history. The fading hope for an heir was somewhat like the hope for all Israel. The hope that a new prophet of God would come, that God would send a king like David again, a holy priest, a Messiah who would make the world all right again. Well, the second sadness in Zechariah's life was one that he still had a chance of being fulfilled. If only his name would come up in the casting of the lot. If only he could get a chance to serve in that ultimate way by offering the incense just once before he died. it would give him such fulfillment, such satisfaction to be the one who was allowed to go in and appointed to go in and burn the incense that represented a communal prayer of the people of God. The people of Israel. A prayer which asked Yahweh God to send the time of salvation for Israel soon. A prayer which might have included, we believe, a plea for the Messiah to then come soon as well. So the atonement sacrifices for sin would no longer be necessary. So, are you now imagining with me how Zechariah was eagerly and expectantly holding his breath while the lot was cast, wondering, would Yahweh remember me, Zechariah, whose name means Yahweh remembers? Yes! It happened! His name came up. He was to be the one to offer incense at the atonement altar this week. The only time in his life when he'd be allowed this task, a task the duties of which he'd memorized early in his life and rehearsed in his mind regularly since to always be prepared lest his name come up. And now he would get to do it. And as he began to fill his duties on that special day, we can then well also understand how Zechariah's senses were fully and all alert. He knew this was special. He wanted to absorb and remember every detail. He didn't want to make a mistake and offend God like Aaron's sons Nadab and Abihu had done, and for which they'd been consumed by fire on the spot pretty well. He wanted to do it just right, to serve God and the people the best that he could. There's a story in the Jewish folklore that after the thing with Nadab and Abihu, that all priests who went into the temple to fulfill service had a rope around their waist and other priests holding the other end of that rope so that if something went wrong, they wouldn't violate the rules and barge in and come and help the person, but they could just drag the person out of trouble. I don't know if it's real or not, but I can imagine people coming up with that. We can also imagine Zechariah being fully alert because he would know that Elizabeth would want to know every detail when he got home. First, he helped make the regular burnt offering, a sacrifice that was offered to make things right with God for any sins the people had committed. And then he went into his special role. Outside, he knew, this always happened, there were people who had made a pilgrimage to come and worship in Jerusalem at the temple. Think of Psalm 95. Come, let us go and worship God. Right? So they were there for that purpose on their pilgrimage. And they were waiting and watching. Watching for signs. They could see the smoke of the incense rise. And so they would know at various stages what the priest was doing inside. And they would pray out there while they waited for the priest to come out and indicate the job was done, that their prayers had been offered by the priest. Some say the prayer that these people prayed while the incense was being offered went something like this. May the merciful God enter the holy place and accept with favor the offering of the people. So, next thing Zechariah did was place the bowl containing the fresh incense on the coals of the altar in the holy place behind the outer curtain. And then as the fragrance and smoke of the burning incense rose from the fire, he prayed on behalf of the people, prayed into the smoke, mixing his words with that smoke. And the rising smoke from the incense was believed by the people to carry the prayers up to God in heaven. Think back to Abel and Cain and their smoke from their offerings. This was how it had been done for centuries, and somewhat uneventfully for centuries. This was how priests had been seeking God's favor on the people for time immemorial. Could have even been just a routine thing for many of them, but it wasn't going to be that for Zechariah today. So Zechariah finished praying for the salvation of Israel, for the Christ to come soon. And it's then that things went very, very strange on him. He'd been so careful to do everything right, and something unscripted happened. He looked up, and someone was standing at the right side of the altar. that he just put the incense on. Somebody was standing there, and he knew it wouldn't be one of the other priests. No, this person was different. I should be pointing over there. This person was different. Zechariah knew no one else was allowed to come in. God had forbidden it on penalty of death. Yet he also knew in the back of his mind, because they were well educated in the Old Testament, that God had promised to meet with his people in this very place. And so possibly for other reasons as well, he recognized that this was an angel, a messenger from God. And he was terrified. It always seems to happen when an angel shows up. There's terror. And it's a normal response for any human when something unexpected happens. Being scared is normal in that. But it's an especially expectable reaction when an angel of God suddenly appears when you are trying to do a sacred ceremony just right. And the angel said to him that if you've ever noticed this pattern before, angels always seem to have to say to humans when they come into these situations, "It's okay, do not be afraid." The angel continued to speak, and he told Zechariah that his prayer had been heard. Talk about an instant response from God. But beyond that, the angel got confusing. Zechariah had not fully recovered from his shock and fear yet, but he distinctly heard the angel say this, "Zechariah," God remembers, "your prayer has been heard. Your wife, Elizabeth, will bear you a son, and you are to give him the name John." But he had prayed for the salvation of the nation. You see how the answer doesn't fit what he had just done in his mind immediately? It's very likely he would not have dared mix in a prayer for a son for him and Elizabeth in that holy place, because it would have been understood as a violation of his duties. He wasn't there to have his own prayer time with God. So it didn't fit what he had just done immediately. But we know that it does, don't we? Because we know the rest of the story. His son John was to be the one who announced the coming of the time of the actual Messiah. Not only would Zechariah's prayer for the people begin to be answered in his son being born, but it would begin to be answered along with an answer to the prayer, their own personal prayer of so many years. What Zechariah no longer expected was going to happen according to this angel. He and his wife would have a son, a child, a son who would be given, who was given the name, his name, by a messenger of God. But Zechariah doesn't quite get that right away, that both prayers are going to be answered in one event, in one birth. What I want to ponder now for a moment is some of the significance of all of this, not all of it. Had you ever noticed before that the angel appeared right after an atonement offering was made? And right after a prayer for an end to atonement sacrifices was lifted to God on a cloud of fragrant incense? Did you ever notice the timing of that before? It's very, very, very significant that it was right then that the angel appears. And not only is the timing of the event itself loaded with significance, but the location of it is even more meaningful. The significance, for instance, would not have been there if the angel had met Zechariah while he was on his way to Jerusalem or from Jerusalem after having served as a priest. Some of the meaning of this would be missing if it had happened there. No, the angel appears at the specific time and place with a message that fits exactly the meaning of what the priest is doing. And this is part of what I talk about and what we talk about when we talk about God becoming present in our worship. He can bring things to us that fit exactly what we are doing in our worship. It's like that. Gabriel comes with a message that the Messiah, the one who would completely eliminate the need for atonement sacrifices, is soon going to arrive. The message is really the end of atonement sacrifices is coming soon. And that message is a message of hope. Advent. Coming. The advent or coming of the ultimate atonement. The time of the coming of the Savior is being described as arriving here in Luke 1. Now, did Zechariah realize how significant all of this was right away? No, not likely. In fact, he had doubts right there. But we have the opportunity and the privilege of looking back at these miraculous events from a time after John the Baptizer and after Christ the Messiah did their work. We live in a time when priests no longer need to make sacrifices of animals. We live in a time after the one who Zechariah's son John came to announce to the world became himself that ultimate unblemished sacrifice that set all who believe in him free from bondage to sin. It's amazing the way God works his wonders, isn't it? It's amazing the way these wonders are recorded for us, the way Luke studied all this and told us about it in a way that highlights significant things. It's amazing the way Zechariah's faithfulness was rewarded, even when Zechariah had lost hope and didn't really expect it anymore, and neither maybe did Israel. Now, it's also amazing from our perspective that Zechariah doubted the angel's message. Have you had that experience when you've heard the story? And say, how could he doubt what the angel was saying? He's in the temple of all places, and it's an angel of all things, right? And yet he expresses doubt. How could he? He doubted it was possible, even though he knew the story of Abraham and Sarah and others. He knew from his sacred scriptures that God had done it before. But then, when we think about it, when we do a reality check on ourselves and set aside maybe our scorn for Zechariah, that even with all the information that we have, so much more than Zechariah had, we at times doubt God's promises as well. We lose hope and faith. We lose track of all of that. Even though we know Abraham's story and Sarah's. Even though we know Zechariah's story. Even though we know Zechariah's son John's story and that the angel's predictions actually happened. Even though we know Christ's story, we all have our times of wavering or forgetting. Even when we've had little miracle stories of our own, we can wander into forgetting and doubting. Well, our passages this morning say to us, don't wonder. Don't wander and don't wonder. Hope. Don't doubt. Believe. Don't question God's promises. Find them in his word and accept them and own them and act on them to live them out. The Messiah, whose arrival is announced here, became the ultimate fulfillment of all God's promises, the pinnacle fulfillment. Jesus Christ is the only hope that can truly save and has saved us from sin. It's available for even those who don't believe it yet. All you need to do is enter into faith in it. And most of us here likely know that. We also then know he wants an active place in our lives. He wants to be present and us to be present with him. And he wants to then in that shape who we are and who we are becoming. But I want to remind you of one last thing. Do you know that there are promises that are yet to be fulfilled? That we maybe have forgotten. Big promises. Like his kingdom coming into full existence here on this earth. A kingdom for which he's always looking for workers. Have we forgotten that promise exists? Big promises like that that are hard to believe every day. A promise like restoring creation to wholeness as a climate summit is meeting and as politicians deal with this in their various ways. there's a promise that stood for the ages that one day the earth will be restored to wholeness. A promise like returning again that's still unfulfilled completely. Are we today hoping for the day when they will be? Come, Emmanuel, come. And God's people said, Amen.